Ralph Ellison won the National Book Award in 1953 for his debut novel, Invisible Man. For the next 40 years, until his death in 1994, he worked on a second novel, but never finished it. But that legendary writer's block is just a part of the story. Arnold Rampersad explores Ellison's life and work in his new biography, Ralph Ellison, which is published by Knopf. I'm very pleased it has brought him back to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
For most of the years following the publication of Invisible Man, Ralph Ellison was a model of the urbane and sophisticated literary figure. What was his childhood like?
His childhood was the exact opposite in some respects. He grew up in Oklahoma City, and his father died. His father, who had come from South Carolina, and his mother had come from Georgia. They had migrated to Oklahoma City. His father died when he was 3 years old, and Ellison, Ralph, that is.
His father died in a dramatic way.
A dramatic way, yes. He was a peddler of coal and ice, and he was lifting a 100-pound block of ice into some sort of grocery store safe, and a shard went through his stomach or punctured his stomach, and he survived for quite a while, but then finally he succumbed to poison, I would guess, some sort of poison.
Wasn't Ellison troubled his whole life by stomach pain? I hate to psychologize.
Yes, no, well. I make the connection too. He would in moments of stress he would complain of suffering from a stomach pain, and he would complain about there being too much garlic in the food that he couldn't eat because his stomach was very sensitive. His stomach remains very sensitive to the end. I've heard that sometimes Mrs. Ellison would put garlic in his food and tell him that there was no garlic in his food, and then he'd be perfectly fine. But
which Mrs. Ellison are we talking about? One of his mother or one of the wives?
One of the wives, Mrs. Fanny Ellison, his wife of almost 50 years.
Well, he grew up in Oklahoma, but he spent most of his life outside of it. How much Oklahoma was there in Ralph Ellison?
I think there was a great deal of Oklahoma in Ralph Ellison. Perhaps it was frozen in amber in some respects. And he would not have gone back to Oklahoma City, I think, if he hadn't been able to return as a conquering hero after the National Book Award in 1953. But he remembered all the people of his youth, his friends, his teachers. He was very nostalgic, very sentimental about the Oklahoma of his youth.
Did people have a sense of much prospect for him growing up in a Jim Crow environment during the Depression?
I don't think so. Well, he lived a sort of double life. On the one hand, he was seen as respectable, a good scholar, good trumpet player, a leader of the student band. On the other hand, his mother was really almost dirt poor, working as a maid when she could find jobs as a maid. I think he found that humiliating in the extreme, and I think it built up a great deal of rage in him that ruled him in a way for the rest of his life.
And a reason he left in 1933, he hopped a freight train and went to Tuskegee University in Alabama. Is that where he would have wanted to go to college?
No. He had hoped to go to Juilliard, as a matter of fact. He had talked about even Harvard. I don't know if he had the grades or had the ability for the Juilliard school, but that's what he wanted. I mean, there was a part of him that was very ambitious from the very beginning, and another part of him that saw reality, and reality was that he was a poor boy who couldn't afford to go off to college at the end of high school.
Well, many people escape through show business, and he was a trumpet player playing jazz?
Not really. I mean, I think he loved the jazz of Oklahoma City.
Because he wrote so much about jazz.
He wrote so much about jazz, and Oklahoma City was perhaps second to Kansas City among cities west of Chicago.
All those great touring bands.
Right. Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, they all passed through, and then several others. But I think that he was caught in the divide, if you like, or the contrast between classical music and jazz music, and he loved them both. I mean, at the very end of his life, he's listening to Prokofiev on the one hand and Louis Armstrong on the other. But there's no doubt in my mind that he wanted to be a classical musician, classical composer in particular.
How is that reflected in his writing? Does it make it less improvisational than it might have if he had been a jazz musician?
Well, I think he prized improvisation. You're absolutely right about that. And when we look at the unfinished novel, the novel that went on for 42 years.
That was published kind of as Juneteenth.
As Juneteenth. And I think a full version is scheduled to come out at some point soon, relatively soon. I think one can say that he improvised perhaps a bit too much, or relied on improvisation a bit too much in that second novel, and it perhaps prevented him from finishing it.
What was Tuskegee like for him?
Tuskegee was very difficult for him. William Levi Dawson, one of the most prominent African-American composers, was in the music school, and Ralph, who had a way of fastening on older men, father figures, hoped that Dawson would be a mentor. Dawson was not that for him, and also, he himself said he was run out of Tuskegee by a homosexual dean of students. So this was yet another strike against the Tuskegee experience. He also had to deal with poverty. Once again, he wanted to live and dress a certain way, and he couldn't afford it, really.
But his ambitions were Juilliard or Harvard, which were largely white schools, and
yes,
he wound up in an all-black school. I don't know whether that was something that bothered him.
Well, I don't think it would have bothered him so much, because it was extremely difficult for a black to get into a white school at that time. So what he would have preferred, I think, would have been to get into, say, Fisk in Nashville, or one of the Atlanta schools, or Howard University. But in fact, he was reduced to trying to get into the Oklahoma State College for Negroes, as it was called, and then ended up at Fisk University, at Tuskegee, the school founded by Booker T. Washington, and it was known really for its agricultural core.
So he quit, and he moved to New York in 1936.
He talked about coming back, making money in New York as a waiter, maybe on the ships plying the Hudson, and then coming back and finishing doing his senior year. But once he arrived here, I think it was clear he was not going back.
And did he give up music?
He gave up music, yes.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I mean, I think he realized, too, that he was never going to be a very great trumpeter. He was never going to be a great composer. And he was after excellence. He was after fame from the very beginning. He was being driven by these demons, if you want to call them that, within him. And he tried sculpture for a while. And then, because he met Langston Hughes and Richard Wright, he turned towards writing.
My guest is Arnold Rampersad, whose latest book is Ralph Ellison, a biography published by Knopf. Professor Rampersad is the Sarah Hart Kimball Professor of Humanities and a member of the Department of English at Stanford University. His other books include biographies of Langston Hughes and Jackie Robinson. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. He was a young Oklahoman educated in rural Alabama. Was he something of a country bumpkin when he came to New York?
I think so. He was a country bumpkin. He took one year-long course in the novel, especially the English novel, in his last year at Tuskegee. And he had been reading, I think, trying to read T.S. Eliot, especially The Wasteland. So there was, just an element of sophisticated knowledge, but it was a trace, really, compared to what he would need to become the person he eventually became, which was a bona fide intellectual and a first-class artist.
But it might have been better if he had arrived a few years earlier. The Harlem Renaissance was kind of winding down by the time he got here.
Yes, it was winding down, most definitely so.
And he didn't want to live in Harlem.
No, he did not. He certainly did not want to confine himself to Harlem. He made it very clear from the beginning, I did not come to New York simply to be bound by, the confines of Harlem, or by the fears of blacks about intermingling with white culture. From the beginning, he wanted to go to Carnegie Hall. He wanted to go to the great galleries. He wanted to partake fully in the university. The university, I mean the city, mm-hmm. Including the universities too, insofar as they, you know, had public programs. So he had that cosmopolitan bent in him from the very beginning.
You mentioned Langston Hughes. He met him. He met Richard Wright as well. What roles did they play in his development as a writer?
He met Langston on the second day he was in New York, quite by accident, in the lobby of the YMCA on 135th Street. And Langston was an enormously generous man. And
already famous?
Already famous, most definitely so. But Wright was about to become famous, and Langston Hughes introduced Ellison to Wright in those 2 or 3 years before Wright hit the jackpot, as it were, with Native Son, which sold $250,000 and a quarter of a million copies, and made him the most famous black writer in America. And it was Wright who became his mentor. It was Wright who said, "Why don't you try writing a review for this publication I'm about to bring out?" And then he said, "Well, why don't you try a short story?" And in both cases, Ellison protested, well, he didn't have the ability, and Wright said, "Oh, of course you can do it." So then he wrote his first published piece of criticism, and then he also wrote a short story that was published posthumously, but was certainly seen by Wright.
Well, he published a lot more nonfiction than fiction, probably mostly essays, some criticism.
In those years, yes, most certainly.
Well, then later, after Invisible Man, the books were both collections of essays.
Yes.
So did he see himself as a better critic and essayist than as a writer of fiction?
Well, some people think Shadow and Act, which came out in 1964, is as important a work of cultural criticism pertaining to black America and to America in general, where race is concerned, as anything anyone else has written. And I don't know if I want to go that far, but it is a remarkable collection. People like Paul Marshall, the novelist, and Ernest Gaines, they swear by that volume. So he had within him this bent to be a cultural intellectual. He worked very, very hard to turn himself into a novelist. And that's, to me, is people always often ask me when I was, as I was researching the book, well, why didn't he write a second novel? But I began to see that the real story was, how did he come to write the first one?
Well, and also, how did people see so much potential in him? Because you have Hughes and Wright both encouraging this man who's just got here.
He was young, he was charming, he was intelligent, and he was well-read. We called him a bumpkin, but he was reading all the time. And Hughes was introducing him to it was Hughes who handed him, you know, copies of novels by Malraux and said, "You should read these." And under Wright, too, his education continued.
Was Wright responsible for his move into radical politics?
I would say so, but of course Hughes was also to the far left. But Wright was actually a member of the party, and I think it's possible, likely, that Ellison, too, was a member of the party, and he published a great deal for New Masses between, say, 1938 or 39 and about 42.
Well, he comes across as a cautious, calculating person to some degree, and I wondered whether Ellison's political alliances were motivated by literary ambition or general social concern.
Well, by both, I would imagine.
Because later he seems to be a lot more ambivalent about politics, or he becomes much more conservative, obviously.
Well, he is deep in the party aesthetic, if you like, in the radical socialist aesthetic, until about 1942, when coincidentally the party begins to be less interested in blacks because they have a different agenda, and he then turns again, to use the word radically, towards a much more cosmopolitan approach to literature. He had, you know, it was about this time that he established the pantheon of writers, his ancestors, as he called them, and Dostoevsky, Melville, Mark Twain, T.S. Eliot, Hemingway, Malraux, and then a little bit later, Faulkner. Those were his gods, his literary gods.
Not Richard Wright.
Not Richard Wright.
Whose Native Son became a huge success, and I wonder what it did to their relationship.
Well, I think it's how it in the first place. When Wright saw Ellison's early writings, he's supposed to have said, "You're stealing my material. This is my style, realist style."
There's more than one realist in the history of literature.
Yes. Certainly, but I think if you look at the earliest writings of Ellison, they are awfully like the short stories in Wright's Uncle Tom's Children. So to some extent, Wright was correct, but Ellison was an artist on the move. He was growing, and eventually he came to despise that the crude realism of Native Son.
Wright was instrumental in Ellison's artistic development and success, but why was Ellison often unwilling to help aspiring black writers when they came to him?
Well, that is a question. that is a very important question, and I'm not sure I can answer it. I think he believed that he had earned what he eventually possessed through a process of extraordinary hard work and also humiliations, and he became to some extent embittered, and he wanted other people to earn their way too. He was very unsentimental about younger black writers, especially in the age of Black Power and the Black Arts Movement, and did not want to know their work essentially, and certainly did not help them in any way. And that was especially true of younger black women writers.
Your biography is quite compassionate, but many reviewers have chosen to focus on the considerable number of Ellison's faults that you have revealed in this book. Did you see him as a very flawed man as you were living with him over all the years of research and writing?
But I saw him as a flawed man, but I never forgot that he had written Invisible Man, which is likely to endure because it is a wonderfully constructed novel on the most important theme in American culture, which is that of race relations and the fate of the black person in America. So I always focused above all on what he had achieved. But I think it is important to make people understand that these achievements come at considerable personal cost. And what some critics have said, is a parading of his faults and flaws is really an accounting of the cost of an extraordinary effort in art.
We will talk about Invisible Man when we come back from a little break. My guest is Professor Arnold Rampersad, whose latest biography is Ralph Ellison, published by Knopf. Stay with us. And we're back with Arnold Rampersad. His latest biography is of Ralph Ellison. It is published by Knopf. When did he begin to work on Invisible Man?
Early in 1945, after a couple unsuccessful attempts to write other novels. But I think the key moment, I think he'd been working on a novel using the trope, the theme of invisibility as applied to the black condition. But I think the key moment was when the sentence, "I am an invisible man," came into his head. And then he launched a first-person narrative that allowed him to create a character who was not unlike himself. It wasn't an autobiographical novel.
But he felt like an invisible man on some levels? Obviously was nothing like an invisible man.
I think he believed that, I think it was Thoreau who said, the mass of men lead lives of quiet desperation. I think he believed that most of us feel invisible at certain times.
Did he have certain literary models at this point? You mentioned some that he cited later, but was Dostoevsky there?
Well, Dostoevsky was already one of his models. Melville is all over.
So it's kind of like Notes from the Underground in an odd way.
Absolutely, consciously so. And Melville is all over the beginning of Invisible Man. I mean, just citing, sampling him.
Well, that would suggest that he was already thinking great American novel. Was he trying to explode American literature, or was he trying to become a member of the group?
I think he was trying for the great American novel. He had that ambition, and he was prepared for the long haul. He had Moby Dick or Absalom as among his models.
And he comes along with this really important book at a time when America is changing. Jackie Robinson had broken the color barrier in baseball. In fact, he'd become the MVP of the National League in 49. Gwendolyn Brooks won the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry in 1950. And then along comes Invisible Man, and it beats out East of Eden and The Old Man and the Sea for the National Book Award.
Right.
Did some people see that as bending over backwards for a black writer, or?
No, there were. I mean, some reviewers said, "Well, this is not the most distinguished book published in 1952, but it's probably the second most distinguished book." People on the far left hated the book, especially black intellectuals and leaders on the far left. One columnist wrote, black people need Invisible Man like they need a hole in the head.
But also it's about disillusionment with radical politics, yes, as much as it's about anything else.
Yes, absolutely. That's the bone of contention, I think.
How did critics respond? Was there a racial aspect to the kinds of reviews he got?
Not really. I mean, when you look at the reviews, they recognize the faults of the novel, but they all spoke, not all spoke, they didn't all speak that way, but most of them spoke about being swept along by a narrative that was like, the great narratives of literary history. And I think he had tried consciously to create, as a central character, a sort of black everyman, but also someone that the nation as a whole could look on and see something of themselves in him. So it was perceived as operating at a provincial, but also at a universal level.
Do we have any idea of how Langston Hughes and Richard Wright viewed the book?
Well, we do. Langston Hughes praised the book to the skies and in his newspaper columns, but there's some evidence that even as he was praising it, he found it impossible to read it, to finish it. He was, again, being extremely generous. Richard Wright had emigrated to Paris, had given up on the United States, and in 1953, the year that Ellison won the National Book Award, he brought out the first novel since Native Son, and it's an interesting novel, but it was a failure, a complete failure. So here you had, the great man circa 1940. Suddenly being in the shadow, decidedly in the shadow of Ralph Ellison and Invisible Man. And I don't think the relationship ever recovered from that.
In his acceptance speech for the National Book Award, Ellison appealed to personal moral responsibility for democracy, which typified the best of our 19th century fiction. And how does he see, or how does the Invisible Man epitomize that tradition?
Well, it questions totalitarianism as represented by the Brotherhood. It questions a worshipping of power, as in the case of the young Invisible Man dealing with the principal of the Black College. It questions philanthropy that really has no powerful moral backbone. So it is continually a moral an exercise in moral questioning. I think that's. And in that way, he saw himself as belonging, joining the tradition of moral inquiry that he identified with people like Ralph Waldo Emerson, for example.
And his name was Ralph Waldo Ellison, so yes, I'm sure that wasn't lost on him.
No, not at all. It was a very important part of his identity, I think.
So how did he react to the celebrity, he and Fanny, his second wife?
Well, I think to me, looking back, it was a kind of Faustian moment. The world opened before him, such as in a way that he had never expected it to open. 1954 came along, the Supreme Court decision. Suddenly, blacks were admitted to places they'd never been admitted to before, and he was in the forefront because he was the most celebrated black writer of fiction and perhaps intellectual on the scene. So he gained honor after honor, membership in the Academy of Arts, a leadership role there, membership in the Century, and just dining with presidents, two presidential medals from Johnson and later on from Reagan. He received his, just a slew of honors and awards, and made a fair amount of money too.
And took him out of the black community to a large degree.
I think it did take him out of the black community to a large degree.
And then in 1956, the Elsons go to Rome for the Academy, the American Academy in Rome, at a time when a lot of things, important things, are happening in this country. And he had criticized Richard Wright and others for moving to Paris.
Well, this was a fellowship for 1 year from the American Academy in Rome, and he renewed it a second year. All the while, he was extremely homesick. He never learned, I think, a word of Italian, more than two or three words of Italian. Why he insisted on staying in Rome when he was so homesick for New York, I don't know, but. It was an important period of his life, but I don't think it did him a whole lot of good.
Well, he comes back to an America where younger writers like James Baldwin and Leroy Jones are making names for themselves, and you get the feeling that this was one of the reasons that he became more and more the dignified, impeccable, a man with the impeccable demeanor of the artist, as T.S. Eliot once said about Matthew Arnold, and has also been applied to him. He became conservative and kind of withdrew from the role that Invisible Man would have naturally put him into.
Well, I think there's another way of looking at it. He believed in the fundamental historic American values enshrined in the Declaration of Independence and the U.S. Constitution and so on. He saw those as sacred documents. It was not a passive exercise, a luxurious exercise for him to stand apart from people like Baldwin and others and the Black Power movement. He saw the Black Power movement as threatening the love of learning, the love of interracial harmony, ideas about justice, and so on. So it was a very active assertion on his part of a fundamental belief in certain principles that I think we all hold dear.
But he chose not to join the March on Washington, where Martin Luther King delivered the "I Have a Dream" speech. He did take part in a public panel discussion on the event. And then 2 days after Martin Luther King's assassination, Ellison spoke at a literary festival but made no mention of King.
Well, that's the paradox. There he is talking about the importance of moral inquiry and returning American literature to the high moral standards of the middle of the 19th century. But in his interaction, and also talking about the beauty of historical Negro culture, I mean, he was always talking about that, especially as represented in jazz and the blues, but he was losing contact with black people and events surrounding the black community.
Ironically, at a time when people were finding new relevance in Invisible Man.
Absolutely so. I mean, he made a great deal of money because of the extent to which teachers and students and general readers during the Black Power period found Invisible Man an extraordinarily attractive text.
Well, since he revered American sacred texts, why not I Have a Dream?
Why not I Have a Dream? I don't know. He
didn't seem to admire Martin Luther King Jr.
He was a skeptical man. He was a doubting man. And it's not his most attractive side in some respects. On the other hand, you might say that he was judicious. He was not interested in illusions and sentimentality. Take, for example, his attitude to black Africa, and especially the march towards independence that swept over, say, Ghana, what became Ghana, and Nigeria and other places. He was not interested in that at all. And when blacks talked about going back to Africa, he saw it as dangerous romanticism.
He also was a supporter of the war in Vietnam. So he was becoming a part of the establishment.
He joined
all those clubs, as you said.
There's no doubt that he was becoming solidly a member of the establishment.
And then the man who wrote Invisible Man had an epiphany about America during a visit to Harvard.
That was somewhat earlier, although I think it really gains true power for him in the period you are pointing to. He goes to Harvard in 1954, invited, by the way, by Henry Kissinger, or he meets Henry Kissinger there, who subsequently invites him to an annual summer conference. And he is looking at a role of the Union dead, the Harvard young men who went off and died. And he said, died for me, for my people. I think he, as he tells it, this was a turning point for him. And I think that in the biography I say that he became a commissioned American, because he came face to face, as far as he was concerned, as for the first time, the fact that this country was founded on certain principles and a lot of people had died, had fought and died to preserve those principles of justice and democracy and so on. And he believed that he too should join that mighty historic effort, except that he was doing it with words but not with actions.
Well, it all depends on how you want to look at it. What he's saying is true, and what W.E.B. Du Bois said was true, and there's perhaps a larger truth. His friends started calling him every white man's favorite black man.
Yes,
one. And people called him an Uncle Tom. Did that hurt him?
Well, in one instance, he's supposed to have, and I think this did happen, he broke down and cried. I think it was at Grinnell College in Iowa, where he was confronted by a rather loud-mouthed, dramatic young black man dressed in black leather and so on, but this was only the most acute example of the kind of criticism he received from blacks across the country, who saw him indeed as a kind of Uncle Tom.
Now, we have not addressed the fact that he never completed that second novel, and he lied about why. He claimed there was a fire when there turns out not to have been a fire.
There was a fire, but
he kept on describing more and more pages lost, and
yes,
he had a second book.
Yes.
So
absolutely.
What was the real reason? Just that he had a writer's block, or he just couldn't pull it together?
Well, he wrote to his good friend Saul Bellow at one point around 1957 or so, "I have a writer's block as big as the Ritz." But I think I agree with John Callahan, who's edited so much of Ellison's work, that Ellison really never had a writer's block. He kept writing and writing and writing and rewriting. Why he could not finish that novel, I don't know. I mean, he was committed to a literature based on surrealism and myth and symbol, with Joycean techniques.
His two favorite words were complexity and chaos. It's hard to work within
chaos,
something like that.
Yes. And he found himself also bedeviled by events happening within American history about him. But he went in circles, I think. He produced some beautiful writing in the course of trying to finish this novel. But in fact, he was not close to it, although he kept saying, it'll be out next year, it'll be out next year.
And then he died just a few weeks after he celebrated his 80th birthday in 1994. Otto Rampersad's biography of Ralph Ellison is published by Knopp, and it's probably the definitive work. You're speaking tonight at the Museum of the City of New York. You might want to check our website for more information. On tomorrow's show, David Rose questions the conviction of a man accused of committing a series of rapes and murders in Columbus, Georgia in the late 1970s, and then the story of how plutonium was developed. And we learn about the Melungeons, a group that lives in isolated areas of Appalachia. Plus, a butcher and a chef answer your questions about meat on Please Explain. By the way, if you've missed something on the show or just want to hear something again, you can listen to archives of past programs on WNYC.org. The Let It Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English, Brenna Farrell, and Blake Neeshick. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Tanya Wiedeking and Sam Howard. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. We'll see you tomorrow.